Why was General George Patton assassinated? The first American home ever stayed in was that of General Ben Parton, US Air Force retired scientist, genius, inventor of cruise missiles, Puff the Magic Dragon, GPS systems to deliver cruise missiles, laser. In fact, he asked me if I knew what laser stood for. And I've asked a lot of scientists around the world, what does laser stood for? Well, I heard from the man who invented it back in the 50s, and he chose the name, Light Amplified Stimulated Emission Radiation, laser. Well, General Ben Parton, whose home I stayed in more than any other American home, he's the first one to have told me, back in 1988, that General George Patton had been murdered by his own government. Strange. Well, Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. The first casualty, they say, in war is truth. Truth does get murdered more frequently by governments, as we have just seen with the present war going on in Ukraine and Russia. There's a lot of lies being told, and it's very hard to tell the truth from the lies. As my history teacher, the first history teacher I had in high school in Rhodesia, Milton High School, was Mr. Rhys Davies, who was also a member of Parliament, and he said, beware the victor's version. He said, you know that the British government are lying about us in Rhodesia now. Why would you believe what they say about anything else? And he said, wartime propaganda morphs into peacetime textbooks. Never regurgitate the textbook. Don't dish up to me what you've learned in the textbook. Do extra reading. Think outside the box. Ask why. Find primary source documents. Get the books written by the people who were there, eyewitnesses and so on. Don't believe governments. Textbooks are produced by government committees. And I must say, good advice, very good advice. Here's a member of Parliament. I remember us asking Mr. Rhys Davies, so how can you be a member of Parliament and a teacher? He said, we don't get paid for being members of Parliament. We need a real job too. Well, that's back in 1973. We don't get paid for being members of Parliament. We have to have a real job too. Imagine if we still had members of Parliament who had to get a real job as well, that they didn't get rich being in government. Anyway, what he said about the way the victor's version, very helpful. Do you know what this is? How many can read Russian? Pravda. Pravda means truth. They had two newspapers in Russia. One was called Pravda, the other was called Izvestia. Pravda means truth, Izvestia means news. And Russians would say, there's nothing true in Pravda, and there's no news in Izvestia. And they knew. And by the way, here's one of the poster childs of Pravda. This is a front page spread on Uncle Joe Stalin and this little girl, and the title of this piece was, Thank You, Comrade Stalin, for My Happy Childhood. Now, this child should have had a happy childhood. I mean, her father was a member of the Politburo, and her mother was very high up in the Communist Party as well. So, she is one of the privileged few. However, within 6 months of this picture being posted on Pravda, her father was arrested and shot, and her mother was imprisoned, and within 2 years, her mother had died. In less than 2 years, her mother died in a concentration camp, and this little girl died within 2 years of this picture being taken. So there's your poster child for communism. Thank you, Comrade Stalin, for my happy childhood. The first casualty in war is truth. And communism killed a lot of people too. They murdered truth as well. The media is not a reflection of reality. Take, for example, this picture. Do you remember 2015, Charlie Hebdo massacre in France? A bunch of journalists were murdered by Islamic jihadist lunatics because they published some blasphemous cartoons about Muhammad. And in came a bunch of Muslim terrorists and they shot up the place. And the leaders of, who knows how many countries, like the leaders of 14 countries something, led over 2 million Parisians down the streets of Paris in this march. And when I looked at this picture, I thought, unbelievable. This must have been a security nightmare. I mean, here's Benjamin Netanyahu. Here's Francois Hollande. Angela Merkel. I mean, what a security nightmare. Leading 2 million people, what brave leaders. But what you need is a bit of a perspective. Such as, maybe there were 2 million Parisians marching somewhere in Paris, but not in this street, and they weren't leading them. You can see the security all around. This is a photo op. Just by perspective, you get the impression, and when you told too many people leading, but actually, it was just a photo op with a whole bunch of selected people. Look at this picture. Here's Barack Hussein Obama in Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, and look where the cameraman is. He's crouching low. Why? To give the impression of this brave, courageous, popular American presence, walking amongst crowds of people spontaneously sporting American flags. And however, this perspective shows you it's only 3D, but people are all wearing the same clothes, and the security is all the way around them. These are obviously a select group. They've gone through metal detectors, they've been selected, they could be rent a car for all you know. But isn't this a completely misleading picture being set up? But I mean, that's reality out there. Karl Marx declared that the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. Have his disciples ever been super busy rewriting history? George Orwell wrote, in a time of universal deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act. So, tonight, General George Patton, one of the most colorful, controversial characters in modern military history. George S. Patton Jr. was born 11th of November. How about that? Born on 11th of November. I mean, how's that for a military date? 1885. His homeschooling consisted of classical literature. Young George Patton obviously grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth and was very privileged, came from a very rich, well-to-do family, and he was obviously very self-confident. In 1903, he went to the Virginia Military Academy, VMI, and the VMI, I've been there, I've actually spoken there too. This is prestigious. This is, in fact, the VMI are so proud, they say, we fired the first shots of the Civil War, which I don't know that that's something to be super happy about, but they're very proud that they fired the first shots of the Civil War. The Virginia Military Institute had students such as General Stonewall Jackson came through them, a lot of great heroes. And VMI is an extremely prestigious, ruthless, harsh, disciplined environment to go to school. Here's a Stonewall Jackson memorial. Well, Virginia Military Institute, cannons in front. Patton was later, once he graduated from there, he went to the West Point Military Academy in 1904. Now, this is where everyone from General Custer to Robert E. Lee came through here. Ulysses Grant, you name it. Well, not to mention General MacArthur, many of those folks. So, United States Military Academy, West Point Chapel, completed in 1910, constructed in Gothic Revival style. During an early 20th century expansion of the Academy, the great sanctuary window is inscribed to the motto of the Academy, Duty, Honor, Country. You may recall that was the speech of General Douglas MacArthur. Duty, Honor, Country. Well, that's the motto of the school. And that's what it looks like today at West Point. And I've been there too, as a guest speaker. And you can see the way they're dressed. Hasn't changed in a century or so. Apart from his athletic achievements, George Patton was a member of the riding, fencing, rifle, and track teams, which was essential martial sports, and they called it the pentathlon. In 1909, he was commissioned 2nd Lieutenant in the 15th Cavalry Regiment. This is still in the days when cavalry was king. This is, there's no Air Force yet, there's no armored cars, there's no tanks. This is 1909. Cavalry is the way you win wars. That's the belief. And so he starts out as a great cavalryman. Here's his wedding photograph. Notice it's very hard to see a picture of George Patton smiling. But apparently he was a cheerful soul. He just didn't smile for pictures. Well, in 1912, he represented the United States of America at Stockholm at the Olympics, 1912 Olympics. He represented the United States in pentathlon, in the Olympic Games, Stockholm, Sweden, when military martial sports were still very much part of the whole competition in the Olympics. And here are some actual pictures from the Olympics in 1912. And you can see how Olympics have changed over the years. Back at that time, you were not allowed to be a professional athlete. Well, as you can see, Olympics now has become totally professional. And the reason for it is the whole Soviet Union. They only had professional athletes, and the West didn't. And so in the end, it was not very competitive because the full resources of the state were behind all the athletes who were professionally selected, even from the time they were four. Taking Nadia Comăneci, for example, of Romania, she was training from 4 years old for the Olympics in gymnastics. And so, you know, how can you compete with that? So the communists changed the whole ethos of the Olympics from being amateur to it all being professional on all sides. Here's Patton at the Olympics doing hurdles and doing fencing. Patton is the one on the right with the more aggressive stance. And he won in all of these. These are just examples. He was superb with the sword, with the horse. Here's General Patton at the Olympics showing his horsemanship. Five classic military skills: horse riding, running, swimming, marksmanship, and swimming. You've got to do all five. That's pentathlon. And in fencing, he came first. That's international, the Olympics. Riding, he is third. He was rated fifth overall out of 43 international contestants. He would have won if he hadn't been basically disqualified in the shooting. The shooting was so good. His target shooting was so well. All of his shots were in the same hole. So they counted that he must have missed, with four shots, the whole scoreboard. And later on, they discovered, after the winners had been announced and so on, in fact, they found all five of his bullets in that center. I mean, everyone, sort of like Robin Hood splitting the arrow kind of thing. he actually should have won, but because they counted that he missed the target with four shots out of five, he lost. And, you know, he's such a gentleman. He did not make a thing about it, because remember the whole thing about sports. I remember this was drilled into us in school in Rhodesia. You must be a gracious winner, you must be a gracious loser. You must be a team player. And so instead of making a scene about it, you just let it run, let someone else take it. Can you imagine the way they behave today with tennis players flinging their rackets on the ground and screaming and swearing at the umpire? That wasn't the way sports was run back then. So here's some of the United States sharpshooters at the Stockholm Olympics of 1912. And General Patton was part of them. Well, after touring Europe, he returned to the USA as a weapons instructor at the cavalry school. He designed a new saber, which was adopted for service. Here's the cavalry saber, 1913, or the Patton saber, one that he designed. Patton on a steeplechase horse in 1914. In 1916, he was posted to Texas and took part in the Mexican War as aide-de-camp to General Pershing. It was at this time that Patton began to wear two revolvers on his belt. 1916, Mexican War, and this is one of the revolvers that he would have used at that time, very engraved, very colorful, ivory handles and all that. Well, Mexican revolutionary Pancho Villa was the target. Although Pancho Villa was a friend of the Americans as recently as 1913, here's General Pershing and Pancho Villa looking awfully friendly at Fort Bliss, no less, in Texas, just a few years before they declared war on Pancho Villa. So sort of like America going to war against Saddam Hussein, who had been their ally for so many years beforehand, or who was the dictator of Panama. You know, just these things go over and over. Pershing was tasked with the task of hunting down Pancho Villa, which was ultimately unsuccessful, but not for lack of effort. The Pancho Villa expedition, they marched and marched, and they tried to find this Pancho Villa, who was turning Mexico upside down. And here's General Pershing, and over here in the dark shade is Lieutenant Patton. General Pershing's headquarters at Galania in Mexico. It's the early days of using vehicles, and the general in charge of the war there, Pershing, getting out of the staff car. 14th of May, 1916, George Patton encountered three mounted bandits and shot two of them dead, returned to HQ with their bodies draped across the bonnet of his car. Very ostentatious. This sort of reflected the mentality, like you'd come back from a hunting expedition with the elk over your bonnet or something like that. So this sort of showed you the kind of man that George Patton was. One of the dead bandits turned out to be General Cardenas, chief of Pancho Villa's bodyguard. So he managed in a gunfight shootout with the six shooters to take out one of the top generals on the Mexican side. The Americans posted a $5,000 reward. This would be akin to $5 million today, the way money is inflated. But for getting hold of Pancho Villa and the $1,000 reward for any of these other accessories of the Bandit. In May 1917, General Patton, Lieutenant Patton, sailed to France in command of General Pershing's headquarters detachment. Requesting a transfer to a combat unit, Patton was assigned by Pershing to establish the Tank Corps. Now, when Patton accepted the posting, he didn't join the Tank Corps. He was the Tank Corps. There was no one else in the Tank Corps, and they didn't have a single tank. The U.S. didn't have any tanks at the time, so it was Lieutenant Patton who obtained the first two-man Renault tanks from the French, learned how to operate them, and trained other Americans in this new martial art. Now, he'd been a cavalryman his whole life, but he recognized the age of cavalry is coming to an end, the age of the tank is coming in. And he is the first American combat officer to seem to recognize it. Overcoming tremendous logistical complications. Remember, in the First World War, they were still needing to use horse-drawn carts for almost everything. In fact, the primary method of transport in the First World War, for 90% of every transport, was horse-drawn. Vehicle was less than 10%. That includes trains. Now a major, Patton managed to field 144 Renault tanks in the Battle of Saint-Mihiel, September 1918. Now, they must have had good intelligence or been phenomenally lucky, because the Germans had this salient. You know what a salient is? A salient is where you've got a bulge, now you're exposed to fire from three sides. That's not tenable unless you can exploit it, rationalize it. You need to collapse your lines back to a shorter line of defense so that you're not as exposed. The salient is extremely dangerous over a long period of time. So the Germans plan to withdraw from the 12th of September. Now, either Americans intercepted the intelligence by radio eavesdropping, or they were just phenomenally lucky, but they happened to launch their attack at the very time that the German line was withdrawing. Of course, most of the news reports didn't put that in. It just was, you know, look at all the ground we gained. Of course, it was a planned withdrawal anyway to rationalize the line, to shorten the line from the German perspective. Well, American troops going forward in the battle line in the forest of Argonne in Reynolds FT-17 tanks, which was the first tanks of the American Tank Corps. So between the 12th to the 15th of September, the American Expeditionary Force was involved in their first tank battle under the command of General Pershing, and the result was a victory, even though it was an easy victory because they were actually occupying territory that was being voluntarily withdrawn from. But nevertheless, this made great news in the papers and in America. The Omaha Daily Bee, Saint-Mihiel Salient Falls. Of course, it came out later that that's exactly the way the German High Command planned it, that they were withdrawing from the salient, but anyway. He was wounded in action, hospitalized for the last days of the war, much to his chagrin. Here's Patton as a temporary colonel at Camp Meade immediately after the war. During war, you can rise in the ranks quite quickly, but after the war, often they take your ranks away and you go back down because they don't need as many colonels, brigadiers, generals, and so on. So between the war years, Patton continued to pioneer the tank warfare in the U.S. Army. And they had interesting kinds of uniforms at that time. You can see he's starting to wear a Colt 45 as well, although he really liked his 357 Magnum revolvers. Here's an order with very specific requirements to Smith & Wesson for a 357 Magnum revolver, exact length of barrel and front sight, and how to be sighted in, and what kind of hole to have, and what type of adapter. So Patton was very specific. He knew what he wanted, and he was very determined. And here's one of the pistols that he got from them with these famous ivory handles. And these are two that he would have worn throughout the Second World War, with GSP, short for George S. Patton, engraved on the ivory handles. Now, General Patton thought so highly of then-General Erwin Rommel, later Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, he kept a copy of Rommel's book on infantry tactics near his bedside for nighttime reading, and also later when he brought out just the tank in attack. So Erwin Rommel was his inspiration and his model. And interestingly enough, my father told me that General McConry, under whom my father served for much of the war in the 8th Army, North African Italy, that General McCormick kept a picture of Erwin Rommel on his bedside table in his tent. And I thought, that just sounded strange. But anyway, I mean, you know, something your father said that you can't forget. It's such a remarkable comment. Well, in 2014, I was invited to speak in England at this centenary of the outbreak of the First World War. And I went to the Imperial War Museum, and aside from the phenomenal exhibits on the ground floor to the First World War, including the Christmas truce, which the British had denied ever happened for generations and banned any discussion, they had full displays with pictures of the Christmas truce, which you were dead wrong if you're a liar and you're a traitor if you did mention the Christmas truce for generations, but now it's just part of the Imperial War Museum exhibits. And on the second floor, they had an 8th Army exhibit, and there they had a recreation of Field Marshal Montgomery's tent with Erwin Rommel's picture on the bedside table next to his stretcher. I thought, remarkable, exactly as my father said, and acknowledged by the Imperial War Museum. Strange things. Well, Rommel said famously, sweat saves blood, blood saves lives, brain saves both. My Old Testament professor at Baptist Theological Seminary, Dr. Fritz House, who was a veteran of the Africa Corps, he ran the 88 anti-aircraft guns, which generally shot aircraft out of the sky, but on other occasions was used against Allied tanks. And Fritz House was a dedicated Christian who ran a Bible study and prayer fellowship throughout the war, every night. And he told me that Erwin Rommel frequently attempted his Bible study when he was attached to his headquarters. And I said, did Erwin Rommel know the Lord? He said, oh, he was born again. He loved the Lord. He feared the Lord for sure. And that explains what an honorable man he was and why my father respected him higher than his own dream. Well, General George S. Patton was recognized as the most ferocious general on the Allied side, American, British, any of them. I mean, there was no general to compare with George Patton on the Allied side. Known as the man who never lost a battle, the hero of North Africa, the hero of Sicily, Patton was temporarily relieved of command for slapping two uninjured privates in military hospitals. So after distinguishing himself in North Africa, he engaged in a contest against his arch-rival British general, Bernard Law Montgomery. As the Germans said, you had two prima donnas competing with one another. And there's a sense in which both Patton and Montgomery were prima donnas who played for the media in so many ways. And they were very flamboyant people. And in many ways, they were in heavy, heavy competition. And while they could smile for the cameras, there was not much love lost between those two men. And this was particularly seen during the Sicily campaign. In a race across Sicily to be first to take Messina, Patton took dangerous tactical chances and pushed his men to the limit. Visiting a field hospital in the crags of Sicily's central highlands, he went from stretcher to stretcher, encouraging the wounded soldiers being treated. Patton was a very emotional man. He really felt for his men. He really cared for his men. He felt deeply the loss of every one of them. He wrote personal letters to the parents of anyone or wife of anyone who died in combat with him. He then encountered a private, Charles Cool, who was sitting, apparently uninjured, on a stool. "Why are you here?" the general demanded. "I guess I can't take it, sir." The general was furious. "You coward," he bellowed. "Leave this tent at once." And as Cool remained motionless, the general slapped him hard across the face with his gloves. He then lifted the man off the stool by the collar of his uniform, shoved him towards the exit, and kicked him in the rear. "You hear me, you yellow bastard? You're going back to the front." In his journal that night, Patton wrote, "If men shirk their duty, they should be tried for cowardice and shot." Now, bear in mind, he was born in a previous century. He had no time for things like shell shock. They spoke about shell shock in the First World War and battle fatigue in the Second World War. Patton didn't know about any of that and didn't believe it even existed. He just saw them as cowards. 2 days later, the general wrote a memo to each of his commanders ordering them not to allow men suffering from so-called combat fatigue to receive medical care. "Such men are cowards and they bring disgrace to their comrades, whom they heartlessly leave to endure the dangers of battle while they themselves use the hospital as a means of escape. You will see that such cases are not sent to the hospital." Now, General Patton did not know about post-traumatic stress syndrome and all this that we've got so many studies on these days. You can have normally courageous men who just after relentless bombardment can just crack. It does happen. It doesn't necessarily mean they're cowards, but these people he encountered probably were. But nevertheless, he was probably being a bit harsh in general, but there's not much doubt that the case he is dealing with were shirkers, what we would call in the South Army chippos. On the 10th of August 1943, Patton encountered a 21-year-old Private Paul Bennett, who was shaking from convulsions and in tears, but apparently uninjured, in a field hospital. "It's my nerves, sir. I can't stand the shelling anymore," he said. Patton roared, "Your nerves, hell? You're just a goddamn coward." As Bennett began sobbing, the general slapped him. "Shut up. I won't have these brave men here who've been shot see a yellow bastard sitting here crying." And the general hit him again. And Bennett's helmet fell to the floor. Sadly, there were journalists present to record all this. "You are a disgrace to the army. You're going back to the front to fight. You ought to be lined up against the wall and shot. In fact, I ought to shoot you right now." And Patton pulled out his ivory-handled revolver from his holster with his right hand, backhanded Bennett across the face, and a medical staff rushed in to intervene and ushered the private out of the tent for his own safety. I mean, everyone around him was shocked, but you can imagine an officer's not meant to hit an enlisted man. I mean, that's pretty serious abuse. It used to be common, but in the American Army in the Second World War, this was considered a crime. So when word reached General Eisenhower, he wrote a stern rebuke to General Patton, who then personally apologized to both the soldiers and to the medical staff who had witnessed his actions. I mean, General Patton was a strong person with strong emotions, and he was actually a very emotional person. He really felt strongly, and he would always visit the tents of the soldiers being wounded. He really cared about them. And so he was also going through a lot of grief over having lost men he knew in the battles, and one should understand it, but nevertheless, he apologized. It takes a courageous man to admit that he had been wrong, and a general apologizing to his troops. He did that. Well, a media campaign in the USA led to such public outrage that the American Congress called for Patton's immediate dismissal. Now, despite his tremendous achievements on a battlefield, in fact, there never was any other American general in the Second World War who achieved as much against such odds as General Patton. And Congress, who you would have thought had higher priorities, wanted to have him dismissed from the service. Can you imagine it? Patton struck ailing soldier. Ailing soldier. In fact, there's no evidence the soldier was ailing at all. I mean, not physically at least. Apologized to him in the army. Well, here's this private Charles Kuhl, slapped by Patton, who made a mint out of his notoriety in the media, and the media really took his case. Patton wrote in his journal, "It's a sad and shocking to think that victory and the lives of thousands of men are pawns to the writings of a group of unprincipled reporters and weak-kneed congressmen." But so it is. Well said. And for this slapping incident, Patton was suspended from duty and he was taken out. He played no part in the invasion of Italy, the war in Italy. He played no part in the D-Day landings. He was just suspended from duty. And so he toured around battle sites in the Mediterranean. He gave speeches in England to raise morale. They didn't use him at all with the D-Day landings or the Anzio landings in Italy or any of these other things. Can you imagine? And the Germans were convinced there's no way they would take their best general out of the front over slapping a couple of enlisted men. This must be a trick. And so the British military intelligence came up with the idea, well, let's at least use Patton for strategic deception. And so they sent him around, make it look like he was about to invade Sardinia, or send him to Crete, where he's planning to take open up a southern front in Yugoslavia. And so they used Patton to mark this deception, because German military intelligence out there was following Patton's movements and assuming he's going to lead the primary assault on Fortress Europe. And they couldn't believe that the Americans would be that dumb to take the best general and take him out of the front line. And so, when it came to the D-Day landings, Patton played no part except as a decoy to give the impression that where he was, and it built a whole fictional army around him, which was made up of blown up dummy tanks and all sorts of things, and artillery pieces made of wood and plastic. And absolutely bizarre, but that's the way it was. And so the D-Day landings, while they started well, they ground down very quickly, and before you knew it, they were stuck and they weren't getting very far. And even though they outnumbered the defenders massively, because they didn't have the dash and the aggression of a Patton, they just couldn't get that far. And so they had to recall Patton finally, give him the Third Army, and then things changed dramatically. And Patton, in fact, saved the whole Western Front, most famously with the Battle of the Bulge, where he took his army, which was way south, and moved it up to save the whole American force that was about to get destroyed at Bastogne in Belgium during the Ardennes offensive. And he had foreseen it. In fact, he had warned Eisenhower's high command that his intelligence sources warned that the German army was preparing for a massive tank offensive in the Ardennes forest of Belgium, which Eisenhower dismissed. He said, there's no way they've got the ability, they don't have that many men, they don't have that many tanks, they don't have the fuel, there's no way they could do it, and anyway, it's winter, it's too cold, and they don't have air supremacy, we do. And so they completely, he prepared his army to change direction. They were focused on Germany, he is prepared to do a 90 degrees turn and to go straight up to rescue the US forces that were going to get flattened in Belgium, and sure enough, it happened. And Patton's Third Army did the most incredible feat of saving the US military from one of the most humiliating reverses and defeats they ever suffered, as the Battle of the Bulge initially was super successful, and Patton alone saved the day. And all American military historians say it's one of the most remarkable features in all of the military history of the US, that he was able to take an army on such a phenomenal distance, march them something like 180 miles in the direction opposite from where they were traveling, and to engage them that they came ready for battle, and it was very harsh winter conditions. And he saved the 101st Airborne, Bastogne, and a whole lot of other things too. Well, despite the Allies continually giving most of the weapons and most of the supplies and the fuel to his rival Eisenhower, Patton still managed to achieve far more than was ever achieved by General Montgomery. So General Dwight Eisenhower ordered the 4 million Allied soldiers in Germany to halt on the west bank of the Elbe River, 60 miles short of Berlin, to enable Zhukov's Red Army to seize the German capital. Patton knew he could get there first. He said he could have gotten to Warsaw before Zhukov, but his petrol was turned off. His supplies were cut. His tanks literally ran out of fuel. Eisenhower even ordered, when he liberates parts of Czechoslovakia, turn back Czechoslovakia for the Soviets. General Patton was seized with fury. Some of our leaders are just damn fools who have no idea of Russian history. Hell, I doubt if they even knew that Russia, just less than 100 years ago, owned Finland, sucked the blood out of Poland, was using Siberia as a prison for its own people. How Stalin must have sneered when he got through with them at all those phony conferences, talking about Yalta, Tehran, and so on. Letting the Russians take Berlin is folly, declared Patton. We should push on as far to the east as possible. We should not stop before Moscow. The Soviets maintained a stranglehold in Eastern Europe for the next 45 years. Patton was right. You let them in, they won't leave. They'll be there for the next generation or so. Millions of civilian refugees fleeing towards the American lines were turned back at bayonet point. Millions ended up as slave labor in Soviet concentration camps. That's people who fled from Eastern Europe, came to the West for freedom, were forced back at point of bayonet, back in the hands of the Soviets. Now, at this point, we should bring in Wild Bill Donovan. How many people know Wild Bill Donovan? Founder of the OSS. Very important character. Franklin Delano Roosevelt turned to one of his classmates at Columbia Law School, Wild Bill Donovan, who was also a skull and bones character and all of that, just like the Bushes, to establish the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which became the precursor to the CIA. Now, Wild Bill Donovan was a hardcore communist. The OSS did the dirty work of assassinations on FDR's instructions. Donovan ensured that Tito's communist partisans waged guerrilla warfare in Yugoslavia, received lavish quantities of American tanks, trucks, jeeps, hundreds of tons of armaments, ammunition, landmines, heavy machine guns, artillery, the works. Yugoslavia would never become communist without the help of SOE and OSS, who always backed the communists and never backed the anti-communists. And there were very strong anti-communist forces in Yugoslavia and all the other places. Here's Marshal Tito, far to the right, in Yugoslavia, May 1944. Tito was one of the most brutal communist dictators of all times, personal friend of Donovan. Here's OSS agent Nick Lalik in the middle, with OSS radio operator Arthur Jivlian kneeling before, with others in Pranjani, Yugoslavia, 1944. This undercover battle, led by Donovan and OSS, ensured that Eastern Europe fell into the hands of the Soviet Union. General Walter Bedell Smith wrote to Winston Churchill that Donovan was out of control with a predilection for political intrigue. Donovan reported only to the President of the United States. He didn't have to report to the Chief of Staff. He was under no military authority. He went straight to the President. OSS was basically a terrorist operation. They did thousands of assassinations, tens of thousands of ambushes and landmines and sabotage. I mean, they were not a normal military operation at all. They did not take prisoners except to torture them and kill them later anyway. Brutal. And so OSS training, they called these guys the Jedbas, and for photographs like Tonto and so on wearing their masks, and code training, and Wild Bill Donovan in the middle here, shown with members of OSS operation groups. These are the forerunners of US Special Operations Forces, Black Ops, and so on. And these people were the best friends the communists had in Red China and Yugoslavia and all throughout Eastern Europe. And they were the enemy of all real freedom-loving people. FDR authorized Donovan to set up the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, which here you can see the site built in 1949. And would you believe it, what's on the floor at the entrance? The verse I start with tonight, "You shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free." I don't think they'd know the truth if they stepped over it, which they do every time they go through the front door. Donovan had no moral or ethical qualms about dealing with communists. He channeled millions of dollars to the Chinese communists of Mao Zedong to fight against America's official ally, nationalist China, under General Chiang Kai-shek. And they did a lot of work to ensure that the communists gained China at the end of the war. They trained and equipped the Chinese guerrillas, and they sabotaged and betrayed the nationalists. Donovan operated the secret slush fund provided by Congress and its War Agencies Appropriations Act 1944. Donovan spent it any way he liked, without any regard to oversight or legality. The money was meant to cover his far-flung spy and sabotage operations throughout Europe and America and Asia. Under the authority of FDR, Wild Bill ordered many political assassinations. On the 17th of April, Patton's single-engine L-5 Sentinel propeller plane was attacked head-on by Spitfire, bearing British Royal Air Force markings. Now, despite Patton's L-5 observation plane for the general being an unarmed American staff plane with American markings, the Spitfire fired the whole nine yards, that's all the ammo they had in their wings, tracers flying past the sides of Patton's aircraft, as his very capable pilot took evasive action. During the maneuvers, the British fighter plane crashed into ground. The general was nagged by a question: was the Spitfire attack an accident, or was it a deliberate assassination attempt? Now, bear in mind, this was part of a flight of Spitfires which maintained altitude, one attacked them. But the British provided thousands of Spitfires to the Soviet Union. Could these have been Soviet-operated Spitfires with British markings and deception operation, or were the British trying to assassinate them? It's more likely this was a Soviet attempt, but still, it's happened in the Western sector. Patton wrote, "Let us keep our boots polished, our bayonets sharpened, and present a picture of force and strength to the Soviets. This is the only language they understand. And respect. If you fail to do this, then I would say that you've lost the war." Even Field Marshal Montgomery agreed with Patton's assessment and ordered his troops to stack the Wehrmacht's rifles in such a way they could be easily redistributed should the British and Germans need to defend themselves against Soviet attack. So Patton and Montgomery saw the need in the prison camps to be prepared and keep enough armaments nearby that they could arm the prisoners if need be, if they needed to work together to defend themselves against the Soviet attack, which was a real threat. Army intelligence warned General Patton that his life was in danger from the NKVD, that's a precursor of what became the KGB, Marshal Stalin had ordered Patton to be assassinated, his top of the list of priorities for the NKVD to assassinate. General Patton opposed the official American policy of forcing millions of former German soldiers to be sent to slave labor in the Soviet Union. These men should be used to rebuild their own country. Patton insisted, and the entire country had been bombed into rubble, they need to be rebuilt in Germany, not going off to Russia and being abused on the way, which is against the Geneva Convention. Don't treat soldiers like that. The roads, the bridges, the plumbing systems all need to be rebuilt. 63 cities in Germany have been bombed into rubble. Multiplied millions of people were without homes. The Germans are the only decent people left in Europe, wrote Patton. It is a choice between them and the Russians, and I prefer the Germans, he insisted. He quoted General Robert E. Lee, and any army who wages war against defenseless civilians, no matter what its excuse, is no army but barbarians unworthy of the name Christian. Now, here's referring to the Yankee Northerners and Sherman's march through Georgia and the war against the South and shelling of Atlanta and all of that. But it applied just as well to what the Soviets and the Allies were doing. General Marshall ordered that Patton's phones be tapped and requested a psychoanalyst from Navy's Medical Corps to observe General Patton. Eisenhower wrote scathingly of Patton, regarding him as a loose cannon because of how he distrusted the Soviets. Well, why would he not distrust the Soviets? While Bill Donovan, who had traveled in and out of Moscow, had direct access to Marshal Stalin, and he loathed Patton. The OSS and NKVD exchanged information like they were friends and allies. They helped one another in espionage projects, including spying on General Patton. OSS agent Duncan Lee was assigned to spy on General Patton when he was military governor of the U.S. occupation zone in southern Germany. He provided regular reports on Patton's movements and recordings and wiretaps of his phone and office. Here's Duncan Chaplin Lee, confidential assistant to Major General William Donovan, founder and director of OSS, who was also a Soviet spy. Here's a double agent. He worked for the Soviet spy agency, the NKVD. Duncan Lee provided the Soviets with advanced knowledge of the D-Day landings, the dates and exact locations of the atomic bomb research in the USA. Duncan Lee testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee, acknowledging all these. These are not conspiracy theories, these are facts established. Duncan Lee, former OSS employee, who was right in the office of Wild Bill Donovan, his most trusted assistant, listens as Miss Elizabeth Bentley, former Red Agent, repeats before the House Un-American Activities her identification of Duncan Lee as a fellow Soviet agent. And he was called a very principled boy by his boss, Donovan. Here's his ID card from a stint while he's aiding the Chinese communists of Mao Zedong. Then there's Stepan Bandera. On the 16th of May 1945, Ukrainian nationalist leader Stepan Bandera defected to the Americans, informed Stepan Skubik of the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps that Soviet High Command has been ordered by Marshal Stalin to kill U.S. Army General George Patton. Lenin and Bandera, enemies. Rather than being shocked at Skubik's news, Donovan ordered Bandera returned to the Soviet Union, thereby silencing the man who was warning about an attempt on General Patton's life. A veteran of the wartime Ukrainian Army insurgents, Army holds up a portrait of UPA leader Stepan Bandera, and they have postage stamps commemorating his life. Ukrainian diplomat Professor Roman Smolstoky said the NKVD will soon kill General George Patton. Stalin wants him dead. Professor Smolstoky was expelled by the Americans from Germany and betrayed back to the NKVD and Russia. Here's Roman Smolstoky. Ukrainian General Pavlo Shandruk informed Special Agent Skubik that he had vital intelligence. Please tell General Patton to be on guard. He is at the top of the NKVD list to be killed. The Americans also betrayed General Skubik, General Shandruk, into the hands of the NKVD to be killed. Why would you trust the Americans when they do that sort of thing? In Berlin, Patton learned that more than 20,000 American prisoners of war, these are American prisoners of war captured by the Germans, but in prison camps in the East that had been liberated by the Soviets. Not one of them was released. They fell into Soviet hands, and at the end of the war, they would be used as leverage in negotiations with the Allies to ensure that all 3 million Russians, Ukrainians, and other East Europeans in Western Europe were forced to cross the border into Soviet hands, which was part of what the Yalta Agreement determined. Not just those Russians and Ukrainians who fought with the Germans against the Soviets, but even their wives and children, even those who had fled Russia in 1917, and those who had been born in Europe, Western Europe, and never even lived in Russia. They all had to be forced back into the hands of Stalin so he could murder them. The Russians denied the Americans and British access to the prisoner of war camps where their own men were being held. There's something like 22,000 American prisoners of war who were liberated by the Russians, died in the Soviet gulags because they wouldn't release them because they were holding them as hostages. First thing they did, I heard this from Captain Red McDaniels, who himself was a prisoner for over 6 years in Vietnam, during the Vietnam War. He set up the American Missing in Action Committee. And General Red McDaniel said that at first the Soviets were saying, if you don't do this, that, and the other, like give us all 3 million Russians, Ukrainians, and their families back, we won't give you your prisoners back. Later they were having, if you don't do this, that, and the other, we'll let your people know that you've abandoned your own people, your 22,000 prisoners of war that we liberated, that you've been playing games with them. So at first, the Americans were doing what the Soviets wanted to get their prisoners back, and later they were doing it to make sure the prisoners never got released so that this scandal was never exposed. That bad. This is documented in the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. The Allied government suppressed information that their men were being held hostage by their ally, Marshal Stalin. Here's a group of Russians captured during Operation Barbarossa. All 3 million Russians and Ukrainians in Western Europe were betrayed in the hands of the Soviets, and most of them were just shot out of hand. They called it Operation Kiobel. This was sealed for 30 years. I remember 1975 coming across a book, the book on the Last Secret. It had just been released, the files, after 30 years. And for the first time I learned that our side could be so treacherous. And there's a lot more that came out after that. General Patton insulted Marshal Zhukov, saying that when he was asked, do you want to see our men and what they can do, he said, the only thing I want to know about you is how I can kill you, how much lead it will take to stop your men and stuff. So Patton was very abusive to Zhukov. Patton publicly stated that the Soviets were the real enemy. Patton became convinced the only way he could speak freely about these issues was to retire from the military. Not just retire, but to resign his commission, so that I can go home and say what I have to say. He saw his battlefield was changing. He was still a warrior, but now the podium and the pen would be his main weapons to expose the treachery of the US government and the danger of their Soviet allies. You've heard in recent years, Russian collusion. They were trying to accuse Trump of having collusion with the Russians. Well, now we can see the real Russian collusion was actually Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. They saved the Soviet Union. They were colluding with Marshal Stalin, one of the worst, most brutal, savage enemies the church has ever had, who killed more Christians than anyone else in all of history. And here they are, the leaders of the free world. Well, one of them was elected. Stalin was elected. Nobody elected church leader, by the way. Not until 1950. No one elected him in 1940. It's just that his disaster that he organized in Norway with the invasion of Norway in 1940 forced the Prime Minister Chamberlain to resign because of the chaos caused in the defeat in Norway. And nobody wanted the job as Britain was losing everywhere. And so Churchill got the job without being voted, much like Britain's got their Prime Minister now, Prime Minister nobody voted for. Well, I also got Prime Minister didn't vote for 1940. By the way, South Africa was being run by his buddy Jan Smuts, who nobody voted for either. Jan Smuts was, he had lost the previous 5 elections against General, Judge, Prime Minister James Barry Hertzog. James Barry Hertzog was South Africa's most popular Prime Minister. He had won 5 elections in a row, beating Smuts every time. But in 1939, he refused to declare war on Germany. He said, it's nothing to do with us. He said, we've forgiven, but we haven't forgotten what the British did to our women and children in the concentration camps during the Anglo-Boer War. This isn't our war. Union Defence Force is not for overseas action. This isn't even Britain's war. It's nothing to do with you. It's nothing to do with us. And Smuts organised a coup, ousted the South African Prime Minister, 1939. No election, no referendum, And Smuts ruled till 1948 without an election. So much like Stalin and Churchill, unelected. So isn't that funny? We've got the democracies. We're all the heads of democracies, like General de Gaulle, who elected de Gaulle head of France. So you've got all these democracies run by people who, well, Poland didn't have an elected leader either. So these democracies were actually not that democratic when you get down to it. Certainly not Stalin. With 18 divisions and more than 500,000 men, the Third Army under Patton was the largest fighting force in history and the best equipped too. Patton was convinced that he could have freed all of Eastern Europe if Eisenhower had not halted his supplies and his fuel. At the end of World War II, America's top military general, combat general, George Patton, accurately assessed the shift in the balance of world power which the war had produced, and he foresaw the enormous danger of communist aggression against the West. Alone amongst the US leaders, General George Patton warned that America should act immediately against the Soviet threat. Unfortunately, his warning went unheeded, and he was quickly silenced by a convenient accident which took his life. Patton warned that America should act immediately, while his supremacy was unchallengeable, to end the danger. Remember, America at that stage was the only member of the Atomic Club, and they had an edge over the Soviets in many ways. In the terrible summer of 1945, the US Army had just completed the destruction of much of Germany. The Royal Air Force played a massive part in that too. But the US Army Air Force bombed by day and the Royal Air Force bombed by night, and they flattened cities, incinerated cities. They poured so much explosive firepower on Germany through conventional weapons that US Army Air Force came to the conclusion it was equivalent of 50 atomic bombs of the Nagasaki type, the destructive power that had been unleashed on Germany through the aerial bombardments. And the country is ruined, wrecked, piles of rubble. And Bremen left ablaze, 1,000 bomber raids. This is the Dresden raid, Valentine's Day, 1945. And they even shelled, rocketed, machine gun civilians on the roads. David Irving's book, Apocalypse, 1945, Destruction of Dresden. The Allies set up the occupation of the ruins to rule the starving Germans, who were in many cases, I mean, if anyone should have been shell-shocked, civilians like those who'd endured 60,000 bomber raids in Berlin, you can imagine how shell-shocked those people could be. And how many had lost loved ones, and how many graves. And of course, they dealt out victor's justice to the vanquished. And now Patton was a military governor. Commander Third Army became military governor of the greater portion of the American occupation zone of Germany, southern Germany, Bavaria. It was only in the final days of the war, during his tenure as military governor of southern Germany, after he'd gotten to know both the Germans and the gallant Soviet allies, that Patton's understanding of the true situation grew. His opinions changed dramatically. His diary and his letters were published by his daughters in 1974 by the Houghton Mifflin Company under the title The Patton Papers. They're sensational. In his diary and his many letters to his family, friends, various military colleagues, government officials, he expressed his new understandings and his apprehension for the future. Several months before the end of the war, General Patton began to recognize the fearful danger to the West posed by the Soviet Union. He had bitterly disagreed with the orders that he had been given to hold back his army and wait for the Red Army to occupy vast stretches of German, Czech, Romanian, Hungarian, Yugoslav territory, which the Americans could have easily taken. They had better logistics, they had better supplies, and they were supplying the Soviets anyway. The Soviets wouldn't have been able to do almost anything with it without the vast amount, the billions and trillions of dollars of weaponry, trucks and everything else that was sent through to the Soviet Union. But Stalin and Churchill here, I mean, honestly, it looks like these guys are pals. It's unthinkable that somebody who was so embodied the West and somebody who embodied Soviet communist mass murder could have been pals. And in Eastern Europe, Yalta is a swear word. As I began my ministry behind Iron Curtain in the 1980s, and then with my parents-in-law and Lenora going behind the Iron Curtain, nobody in Eastern Europe had a good opinion about the Second World War or the Allies. You betrayed us. What do you mean we betrayed you? You Allies, you betrayed us. What do you mean? We never got any freedom or peace or democracy. You betrayed us in the hands of Stalin. What do you mean we betrayed you? Well, the Americans, the British. I suppose even the Rhodesians, South Africans, we were part of it in a sense. I mean, we thought we were fighting for freedom and democracy and Christian civilization, said Ian Smith to me. We didn't realize we were actually saving the Soviet Union. It would have been much better if we'd actually joined an Eastern Front to flatten the real enemy, Ian Smith said. It was the Soviet Union. We would have saved Africa. And probably Europe too. And here you can see Pals, Stalin, Churchill. Look at this propaganda garbage. The Soviet flag next to the Australian flag and the Taiwanese flag. And, well, that wasn't Taiwan, that was Nationalist China, that's it. Britain, Norway, America, united. Well, this was what the price of guilt was, betraying 150 million Christians behind the Iron Curtain. President Truman was part of this too. Well, the 7th of May, 1945, just before the German capitulation, Patton had a conference in Austria with US Secretary of War, Robert Patterson. Patterson was challenged by Patton, who was gravely concerned over the Soviet failure to respect the demarcation lines separating the Soviet and the American occupation zones. He was alarmed by plans in Washington for immediate demobilization of most of the US Army. Patton said, "Let us keep our boots polished and our bayonets sharpened and present a picture of force and strength thrown on to the Russian army. This is the only language they understand and respect." Patterson replied, "Oh, George, you've been so close to this thing so long you've lost sight of the big picture." Patton said, "I understand the situation. The Soviet supply system is inadequate to maintain them in a serious action that I could put to them. They have chickens in a coop and cattle on the hoof. That's their supply system. They could probably maintain themselves in the type of fighting I could give them for 5 days. After that, it would make no difference how many million men they had. And if you wanted Moscow, I could give it to you. They lived on the land coming down. There's insufficient left for them to maintain themselves going back. Let's not give them time to build up their supplies. If we do not, then we have had a victory over the Germans and disarmed them, but we failed in the liberation of Europe. We've lost the war." And with the Iron Curtain coming, this is prophetic. He saw it. He wasn't the only one who saw it, but he spoke about it. Patton's urgent prophetic advice went unheeded by Patterson and the other politicians and only served to give warning about Patton's feelings to alien conspirators behind the scenes in New York, Washington, and Moscow. The more he saw the Soviets, the stronger Patton's conviction grew that the proper course of action was to stifle communism there and then while the chance existed. The army's trained, they're motivated, they're at high readiness, they've got the supplies, they've got the ground, they're over there. Why wait? Later, in May 1945, he attended several meetings and social affairs with top Red Army officers and evaluated them carefully. He noted in his diary, May the 14th, "I've never seen in any army at any time, including the Imperial German Army of 1912, as severe discipline as exists in the Red Army. These officers, with few exceptions, give the appearance of Mongolian bandits." Patton's aide, General Herbert Gay, noted in his own journal for the 14th of May, "Everything the Russians did impressed me with the idea of cruelty." Nevertheless, Patton knew the Americans could defeat the Reds then, but perhaps not later. On the 18th of May, Patton noted in his diary, "In my opinion, the American army as it now exists could beat the Russians with the greatest of ease, because while the Russians have good infantry, they're lacking in artillery, air, tanks, and knowledge of the use of the combined arms. Whereas we excel in all three of these. If it should be necessary to fight the Russians, the sooner we do it, the better." 2 days later, he repeated his concern. He wrote to his wife, "If we have to fight them, now is the time. From now on, we will get weaker and they will get stronger." Having recognized the Soviet danger, Patton urged a course of action which would have freed all of Eastern Europe from the communist yoke with expenditure of less American blood than was spilled in Korea and Vietnam, and would have obviated the need for either of those wars. Patton next came to evaluate the nature of the people for whom World War II was apparently fought. Most of the Jews forming over Germany immediately after the war came from Poland and Russia, and Patton found their personal habits shockingly uncivilized. He had pretty politically incorrect views. The abuse of the prison guards, the massacre of prison guards, in this case they weren't prison guards, this is the documented massacre at Buchenwald in Dachau, down in Bavaria, which was the first of the concentration camps. And the prison guards had left, and they called in some military units, Waffen-SS, to come and hand the camp over to the Americans when they arrived. And when Americans arrived, they just shot all the guards out of hand. They actually filmed it. They killed hundreds of these men, their hands up. As you can see, they just shot the people. And it was they documented their own massacres. And he was disgusted by the behavior in the camps for the DPs, displaced persons, which the Americans built for them, and even more disgusted by the way they behaved when they housed in German hospitals and private homes. He observed with horror, these people do not understand toilets and refuse. Use them except as repositories for cans, garbage, and refuse. They decline where practical to use latrines, preferring to relieve themselves on the floor. He wrote in his diary of one DP camp, although room existed, they were crowded together to an appalling extent. In practically every room, there's a pile of garbage in one corner, which was also used as a latrine. He said that we were only forced to desist from their nastiness and clean up the mess by the threat of butt ends of our rifles. Of course, I know the expression, lost tribes of Israel, he wrote, applied to tribes which disappeared, not to the tribe of Judah from which the current SOBs are descended. However, it is my personal opinion, said Patton, this too is a lost tribe, lost to all decency. You can see why he was getting unpopular, making comments like this. Patton's initial impressions of the Jews was not improved when he attended a religious service at Eisenhower's insistence. His diary entry for September the 17th, 1945, reads, this happened to be the feast of Yom Kippur. So they all collected in a large wooden building, which they called a synagogue. It behooved General Eisenhower to make a speech there. We entered the synagogue, which was packed with the greatest stinking bunch of humanity I've ever seen. When we got about halfway up, the head rabbi, who was dressed in a fur hat similar to that worn by Henry VIII of England, and the surplice heavily embroidered, very filthy, came down and met the general. The smell was so terrible I almost fainted. Actually, about 3 hours later, I lost my lunch as a result of remembering it. Now, these experiences and a great many others firmly convinced Patton that they were an especially unsavory variety of people and hardly deserving of all the official concern of the American government. Another September diary, from a demand from Washington that more German housing be turned over to Jews, he summed up his feelings. Evidently, the virus started by Morgenthau and Barak of a Semitic revenge against all Germans is still working. Harrison, U.S. State Department official and his associates, insist that they feel German civilians should be removed from their homes for the purpose of housing displaced persons. There are two errors in this assumption. First, when we remove an individual German, we punish an individual German, while the punishment is not intended for the individual. Furthermore, it's against my Anglo-Saxon conscience to remove a person from their house, which is a punishment without due process of law. He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both of them alike on abomination to the Lord. Proverbs 17:15. This is Ilra Ehrenberg, propaganda chief of Stalin. Title, Kill the Jew. Kill them all, men, women, children, babies. Kill them all, don't spare one. And on, I mean, it's the most hideous thing to read. And this was distributed to all Russian troops before they came in. And they were commanded to rape, murder, mutilate, torture. And here you can see how the French treated people who they said had collaborated or fraternized with the enemy. And so the public, I mean, just look at the kind of sadistic delight of people as they shave these poor people's head bald and treat them abominably and just shockingly abuse these people because they had gone on dates with some occupation officers or something like that. Camps located between the American and Soviet zones were organized for refugees, political prisoners, prisoners of war, forced laborers, displaced persons. In the second place, Harrison is believed that displaced persons are a decent human being, which he is not. So Patton was horrified by the destruction of churches by the Red Army and just the horrific behavior. One of the strongest factors influencing General Patton's thinking on the conquered Germans was the behavior of the American-controlled news media towards him. At a press conference in Regensburg, Germany, May 8, 1945, immediately after Germany's surrender, Patton was asked whether he planned to treat captured SS troops different from other German prisoners of war. Remember, there was a million Waffen-SS who came from every country in Europe. there's a, I mean, even at Swedish, Swiss, Spanish, South African, British, I mean, there's volunteers from all over, huge amounts from Netherlands and France and Norway, Sweden, Ukraine, Russia. Waffen-SS was a military force. They're not to be confused with the SS Totenkopf camp guards. I mean, the Waffen-SS were military. But anyway, so he said, no. SS means no more in Germany than being a Democrat in America. There's no reason for trying someone who's drafted into this outfit. With great reluctance, and only after repeated promptings from Eisenhower, did he throw German families out of their homes to make room for more than a million German Jewish DPs, displaced persons. Part of, he said, the famous 6 million who had supposedly been gassed that he balked when he ordered to blow up German factories, in accordance with the famous Morgenthau plan to destroy Germany's economic base forever. They were actually ordered, blow up all the industry, blow up all the factories. He wrote, I doubted the efficiency of blowing up factories, because the ends for which the factories are being blown up, that is to prevent Germany from preparing for war, which it had already been bombed to pieces anyway, can equally be attained through the destruction of the machinery. Well, the buildings can be used to house the thousands of homeless persons. I mean, why blow up the buildings? Just remove the machinery. Similarly, he expressed his doubts to his military colleagues about the overwhelming emphasis being placed on the persecution of every German who had previously been a member of the National Socialist Party. In a letter to his wife, he wrote, I'm frankly opposed to this war criminal stuff. It's not cricket. It's Semitic. I'm also opposed to sending POWs to work as slaves in foreign lands like Russia, where many will be starved to death in the gulags. And these prisoners of war weren't just prisoners captured by the Russians. In many cases, these are German prisoners were captured by the Americans, shipped over to Russia to work as slaves. They shipped some to France to be used as slaves in France. They weren't treated as badly as those who shipped to Russia, but they were treated badly. And then there were millions of Germans displaced from their homes in the Caucasus, in the Volga, in Russia, all throughout the Crimea, millions and millions and millions evicted from their homes, their farms. Some of them had been there since Catherine the Great, hundreds of years, forced away from their homes. Millions died in these forced removals. And here's just some pictures of German refugees from East Prussia fleeing the Red Army, and absolutely tragic how so many people lost their homes and lost their lives. Nearly half of the refugees died of cold, starvation, disease. It was one of the harshest winters in Europe's memory. And of course, labor camps in the Soviet Union were Arctic hellholes where millions went and only a few tens of thousands came back. In fact, vastly more German soldiers died after the wars in prison camps than died in combat during 6 years of the war. And of course, civilians too. Huge amounts of slave labor in the Soviet gulags and the Soviet Union. And of course, this offended Patton in the sense of free, fair play. And he understood the communists are the real enemy and the Soviets are the enemy of freedom, of Christianity. The Gulag archipelago. Knowing the true evil of the Soviet Union, the Soviets killed over 62 million people, according to Professor R.J. Rummel's Death by Government book. In fact, this is put much higher by Death by the Communist Black Book of Communism and also by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. But this is just Professor Rummel's book, Death by Government, very, very well documented. So the Soviets, biggest mass murderers in the history of the world, and they meant to be our allies, and we saved them, and we enabled them, and we handed over vast amounts of Christian peoples in Eastern Europe to their tender mercies. And Joseph Stalin put it like this, one death is a tragedy, but 1 million is just a statistic. Communism killed at least 100 million people in the 20th century. In fact, it's a lot more, we've got the stats, but isn't it interesting, communism has been praised in so many universities and it's got the worst track record of any political system in the history of the world. And these poor people displaced at the end of the war, absolute tragedies. The war itself was a tragedy, but the aftermath of the war was another tragedy, especially in Eastern Europe. And those poor people just starved to death, brutalized, eating out of dustbins, and this was deliberate policy. Absolutely horrific. Despite his disagreement with official policy, Patton did, as a soldier, have to follow the rules laid down by Morgenthau and others back in Washington as closely as his conscience could allow. But he tried to moderate the effect, and this brought him into increasing conflict with Eisenhower, who's overall in command, supreme commander, and other politically ambitious generals. In another letter to his wife, he commented, "I've been at Frankfurt for a civil government conference. If what we're doing to the Germans is liberty, then give me death. I can't see how Americans can sink so low." In his diary, he wrote, "Today we received orders in which we are told to give the Jews special accommodations. If for Jews, why not Catholics, Mormons, etc.? We also turn over the French. Several hundred thousand prisoners of war to be used as slave labor in France." It's amusing to recall that we fought a revolution in defiance of the rights of man, in defense of the rights of man, and a civil war to abolish slavery. Now we've gone back on both principles. It is an abomination for kings to commit wickedness, for a throne to be established by righteousness. His duties as military governor took Patton to all parts of Germany and intimately acquainted him with the German people and their conditions. He could not help but compare them to the French, the Italians, the Belgians, and even the British. This comparison gradually forced Patton to the conclusion World War II had been fought against the wrong people. Now, just a bit of a look back to the 1930s. Germany had the highest standard of living in the world in the 1930s. In terms of airships, fast cars, sleek motors, wide streets, boulevards, massive high stands. No country in the world had such high technology. Berlin Olympics 1936, TV, color films, everything that you could imagine. The standards were so high that it was said that after the Berlin Olympics 1936, it was determined this country must be destroyed. If the West of the world understood, I mean, and of course it was a country without a central bank, without Rothschild banking, where they worked on trade by bartering. Argentine gave them beef, they gave them VWs and so on. And, you know, petrodollars weren't part of the exchange rate, and there was this real anger and desire, no matter what, we've got to destroy this country. And after a visit to Ruhr, Berlin, he wrote to his wife, and these are pictures immediately after the war. This is what Berlin looked like, the biggest rubbish heap in the world, biggest pile of rubble, ruined lives, wrecked civilization, gruesome harvest, crimes and mercies. James Buck of Canada wrote this book on the fate of German civilians under Allied occupation 1944 to 1950, where he again recounted more civilians died after the war than during the war from the bombings by deliberate starvation tactics. "Berlin gave me the blues. We have destroyed a good race and we're about to replace them with Mongolian savages. All of Europe will become communist. It said for the first week after they took Berlin, all the women who ran were shot and those who did not run were raped. I could have taken Berlin," said the Soviets, "had I been allowed. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you." Why is the West in a mess it's in today? Well, having worked amongst persecuted Christians in Eastern Europe and with Bill Bethlen through 27 countries, I can say the fact that we betrayed so many hundreds of millions of Christians into communist hands because we saved the Soviet Union, surely what we're experiencing in the West is part of the judgment of God on wicked, evil people who have legalized blasphemy, pornography, abortion, euthanasia, kicked the Bible and prayer out of schools, and saved and served communists who have brutalized Christians, destroyed churches, tortured Christians. How on earth can God not judge such evil? This conviction that the politicians had used him and the US Army for a criminal purpose grew in the coming weeks. During a dinner with a French general, Alphonse Juin, in August, Patton was surprised to find that the Frenchman was actually in agreement with him. Alphonse Pierre Juin, commander of the French expeditionary force that landed at Normandy, he said, "It is indeed unfortunate, mon general, that the English and Americans have destroyed Europe, the only sound country, and I do not mean France. Therefore, the road is now open for the advent of Russian communism. Germany has been the bulwark for Europe to protect it against communism for all these years, and now we've destroyed the greatest enemy communism ever had in Europe." Later diary entries and letters to his wife reiterated the same conclusion. He wrote, "Actually, the Germans are the only decent people left in Europe. If it's a choice between them and the Russians, I prefer the Germans." who certainly proved to be some of the most incredible athletes and military people in the history of the world. I remember my daughter getting into trouble for posting this picture on Facebook of a soldier showing kindness to an animal during war, and the amount of people getting hostile, but some private soldier giving some milk out of his canteen to some, but the amount of hatred that's been engendered by Hollywood, so that you blame everybody of one nation, demonize them. This is the power of Hollywood. So then they climb down your throat and you suddenly find yourself victim of cyber hate because you posted a picture which was well meant, had a simple message from We Love God's Animals. A good man is kind to his animals, but the wicked are cruel to theirs. That's the only comment. And wow, the amount of hatred that came for posting this picture. 2nd of September, Patton wrote, what we are doing is to destroy the only modern state in Europe so that Russia can swallow the whole. Remember, out of Germany came everything from rockets, helicopters, all kinds of advanced. They had the highest standard of living on every level. Do you know that their workers were getting 6 weeks leave a year? They were getting ship cruises and all sorts of things, which was unheard of in those days. The amount of high standards. Do you know, in Germany, you could get, I mean, these are the sort of things people don't want you to talk about, but in 1930s, if you got married, they gave you 1,000 marks loan, which was enough to buy a house. 1,000 marks. For every child born, they'd deduct a quarter of that debt. So you have 4 children, you own your house. Imagine if you had that sort of policy today. But no, you're going to be debt slaves for most of your life, paying back all sorts of things. The banksters. Really. Well, this is what you can see here, not a real general amongst them. These are all just the politicos wearing a military uniform. Marshal Zhukov with General Eisenhower. There's a book out on General Eisenhower called The Politician, because that's what he was. He was a politico. And General Patton told me that Eisenhower was a clerk of MacArthur. At one stage, MacArthur was asked when Eisenhower was running for president, what do you think of Eisenhower running for president? And General MacArthur said, I think he'll make good president. Best clerk I ever had. And, I mean, that's the thing. Eisenhower never heard a shot fired in anger. He wasn't a combat soldier. He was a major on a cocktail circuit in Washington, D.C. in 1941. And he was chatting up the daughter of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He said, wait right here. I've got to introduce you to Dad. And she went through to the White House, to the Oval Office, spoke to Dad and said, I found a man to run your war in Europe. Now, here's a major. He suddenly leapt from being major over the colonels and brigadiers and generals to becoming commander-in-chief, supreme commander of all Allied forces in West Europe. Why? He was the right political person. And he was not the kind of soldier who got in the front line and got dirty. Here you can see a real soldier with a politician on one side and another politician on the other, except the one politician was dressed in uniform. And they divided up Berlin. Has this ever been done in the history of the world? And they had a courtroom where they put on trial. And who were the judges? Judges included a Soviet general who himself was a major war criminal. This is how German officers were imprisoned in France. No roof, rain, snow, no privacy, no plumbing. Just put in these drums where the guards would walk up and down on these planks and the abuse. James Bach, journalist from Canada, documented other losses. How, under Eisenhower, 1.1 million German soldiers died in prison camps in the year after the war. More German soldiers died in Allied prison camps after the war than died in combat during the war. And his documents are absolutely horrific. They didn't put them in prison camps. They put them in open fields, what they called the Rhineland fields, and they just put barbed wire around, didn't give them any equipment, didn't feed them, let them starve to death, machine gun everyone who tried to get away. They died of thirst while there's a Rhine River flowing nearby. They shot civilians to try to bring them food. They forbade the Red Cross from Switzerland bringing millions of food packages. Switzerland had 12 million food packages for this. For the people in Germany during the aftermath of the war, during the worst winter, Allies would not allow them to distribute the food packages, refused. They wanted Germany to lose a few million people of starvation during the cold winter, and the Eisenhower's camps killed 1.1 million German soldiers after the war in prison camps like this. If you've seen The Great Escape and you've seen the quality of the prison camps that the Allies were put up in, and you compare it to this. And then there were prison guards who would just randomly shoot into the prison camps. There's many cases. Many who had never been in combat, just machine gunning into the prison camps and not getting tried for it because they just wanted to have the joy of having killed some Germans. Here's a women's camp, men's camp, just separate by some barbed wire, totally in open, no facilities, no tents, no food. People had to make holes in the ground, use some of their clothes to try and improvise. It was horrific. By the time the Morgenthauist and media monopolists had decided Patton was incorrigible and he must be discredited. So they began a non-stop hounding of Patton in the press, a la Watergate, accusing him of being soft on Nazis, continually recalling an incident in which he had slapped a Sherpa 2 years previously during the Sicily campaign. A New York newspaper printed a completely false claim that when Patton had slapped a soldier, who turned out to have actually been Jewish, he had called him a yellow-bellied Jew, which is not true. He didn't even know, and it didn't matter what religion or background he was. He was crying in the tent and he wasn't injured. That was all that Patton saw. Then the press conference on the 22nd of September, reporters hatched a scheme to needle Patton into losing his temper and making statements that could be used against him, and the scheme worked. The press interpreted one of Patton's answers to their insistent questions as to why he was not pressing the Nazi hunt hard enough as, "This Nazi thing is just like a Democrat-Republican fight." The New York Times headlined the quote, and other papers picked it up across America. And the unmistakable hatred which had been directed at him during the press conference finally opened Patton's eyes to what was afoot. Give a dog a bad name, you might as well hang him. Discredit him, and then you can assassinate him. He wrote in his diary, there is a very apparent Semitic influence in the press. Marxist, Satanist characters behind all this. They are trying to do two things. First, implement communism, and second, see that all businessmen of German ancestry and non-Jewish antecedents are thrown out of their jobs. They have utterly lost the Anglo-Saxon concept of justice and feel that a man can be kicked out simply because somebody else says he's a Nazi. They're going to be quite shocked when I told them I would kick nobody out without a successful proof of guilt before a court of law. What a shocking idea. Another point which the press harped on was the fact that we were doing too much for the Germans. Instead of the DPs, most of which are Jews, he said, I could not give the answer to that one because the answer is that, in my opinion, and that of most non-political officers, it is vitally necessary for us to build up Germany now as a buffer state against Russia. In fact, I'm afraid we've waited too long. In a letter to his wife, he said, I'll probably be in the headlines before you get this. As the press is trying to quote me as being more interested in restoring order in Germany than catching Nazis, unless we restore Germany, we will ensure that communism takes America. Eisenhower responded immediately to the press outcry against Patton and made the decision to relieve him of his duties as head of the Third Army and of military governor. He kicked him upstairs and made him commander of the 15th Army, which is a paper army which had no soldiers. In a letter to his right, he said he wasn't unhappy with his new assignment because I liked it much better than being a sort of executioner to the best race in Europe. He is now put in charge of writing a history of the war, basically. 15th Army was just a few people with typewriters and a couple of filing cabinets. He wrote a letter to a friend back in the States condemning the Morgenthau policy, which was basically to exterminate Germany, and against Eisenhower's behavior in the face of all these demands. The strong pro-Soviet bias in the press, the politicization, the corruption, the degradation, the demoralization of the US Army, these things, he saw the demoralization of the US Army as a deliberate goal of America's enemies. I have been just as furious as you at the compilation of lies which the communist and Semitic elements of our government have leveled against me and practically every other commander. In my opinion, it's a deliberate attempt to alienate the soldiers' vote from the commanders, because the communists know that the soldiers are not communist. They fear what 11 million votes of veterans will do. Imagine 11 million soldiers returning. And this is the interesting thing. Do you know that when the soldiers returned from Europe to South Africa and to America, crime went down, Do you know the South African Army was selling the now antique weapons of bolt-action rifles? You could buy a bolt-action 303 for R2 and it's thrown a case of ammunition free. And with our countries being flooded with weapons, captured weapons, souvenirs, and surplus weapons being sold to the civilians, crime went down, violence plummeted. 11 million soldiers returned home to America, hundreds of thousands of South Africa, and crime went down. What does that do? I should not start a limited counterattack, which would be contrary to my military theory, said Patton, but I should wait till I can start an all-out offensive. Here, speaking to Omar Bradley. Here's Dwight Eisenhower with his forces and Omar Bradley to the far left. Here's Omar Bradley pinning the bronze cluster on the lapel of General George Patton. 22nd of October, he wrote a long letter back to Major General James Harbord back in the US. He bitterly condemned the Morgenthau policy and all the corruption that was going on there. Now, Morgenthau was the Secretary of the Treasury, top advisor to President Roosevelt, and a communist. Morgenthau was the author of the infamous Morgenthau Plan to wipe out the German people, seeing the mass starvation of Germans from 1945 to 1950. Their plan. Absolutely disgusting. He saw the demoralization of the army as a deliberate goal of the enemies of the United States of America. And that it's deliberate, trying to alienate the soldiers from the commanders. And he said, when I finish this job, which should be around the first of the year, I shall resign, not retire, just retire, I'll still have a gag in my mouth. I should not start a limited counterattack, which is contrary to my military theories. I'll wait till I can start an all-out offensive. But unfortunately, his warnings went unheeded. He was quickly silenced by a convenient accident which took his life. The collision on 9th of December 1945 occurred when a 2.5-ton truck, which had been parked facing the general's car, roared into life and violently collided with the general's staff car. By suddenly and inexplicably careening directly in the opposite lane and into Patton's vehicle, there was no road that he could turn into. This is a deliberate turning a truck into the general's car. The actions of the truck driver seemed designed to intentionally injure or kill the general. Both the driver of the truck and the two passengers quickly vanished. No criminal charges were ever filed. No accountability was ever recorded. The official accident reports and key witnesses went missing. As we started tonight, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free, which is written over the entrance to the Central Intelligence Agency in America. Despite General Patton's rank and fame as America's most audacious, successful combat general, there was no formal inquest, there's no official reports on the incident, and those reports that were there vanished. The military police who arrived at the scene of the car accident, Lieutenant Peter Babalas, treated the incident like a fender bender. Although Patton's driver testified the truck driver and the two passengers were drunk, Sergeant Robert Thompson's blood levels were never tested. He was never charged with driving under influence. Thompson's illegal possession of the signals truck also went unquestioned, despite the fact he is 60 miles north of his duty station with no apparent reason of being in Mannheim. Thompson's drunkenness, negligence, apparent larceny, using a truck that he had no right to, all went unquestioned. Numerous investigators and authors have attempted to find the official accident reports unsuccessfully. Sergeant Robert Thompson's two friends who were responsible for plying their truck into Patton's car were flown to England by army intelligence. However, just 4 days after the collision, Thompson mysteriously reappeared in Germany, where he spoke to American journalist Howard Smith, claiming he was alone in the truck when struck Patton's vehicle. But General Hobart Gay and Private Horace Wooding swear there were two other people in the truck with Thompson. In fact, the driver, Private Woodring, 19-year-old son of a dairy farm in Kentucky, grew up racing cars, flying stunt planes. Patton spoke of him very highly. He trusted him. He was a good driver. Woodring was driving just 20 miles an hour when Robert Thompson swerved the military truck hard to the left, driving his vehicle directly into the path of Patton's Cadillac. There's no turning in the road in the direction he's pointing the heavy army truck. He didn't signal before taking the action. The action seemed deliberate. Woodring testified, I was not more than 20 feet from the truck when he began to turn. Thompson made no attempt to brake, instead he accelerated directly into the Cadillac. General Patton was flung forward from his back seat, his head slamming violently into the steel compartment behind Woodring's driver's compartment. His nose broke, he felt a sharp pain in the back of his neck, no sensation in his lower body. Instantly, George Patton knew he was paralyzed. He was the only person injured in the collision. Nobody else was injured. General Patton was paralyzed in his vehicle collision, 9th of December, 1945, at 11:45 a.m. He arrived at the U.S. Army 130th Station Hospital at 12:43 p.m. They drove past other hospitals to take him to this one. There was no medical staff waiting at the hospital to rush Patton to surgery. There was no team of spinal specialists assembled to deal with his life-threatening traumatic injury. 2 days later, his wife Beatrix and a spinal cord specialist arrived to be at his side. The doctors were confident the general could survive his injuries and might be able to regain some mobility. They were also convinced he'd be able to travel soon, and they were shocked at how he was being treated, which was contrary to design to make him recover. General Patton urged his wife, get him out of the hospital. He said, they're going to kill me here. He was emphatic about that. However, he did not recover. And on 21st December 1945, General Patton's body was wheeled into the makeshift morgue in the hospital basement to announce to journalists that he had, all these journalists had descended on the hospital, that General George Patton had died. Now, actually, he was recovering and talking about going back to America and being flying back to America in time for Christmas. There was no autopsy. And although Beatrice wanted him buried at West Point, the Army insisted he must be buried at the American Military Cemetery in Ham, Luxembourg. They couldn't get him in the ground quick enough. Neither General Dwight Eisenhower nor President Harry Truman attended the military funeral for General George Patton, America's most famous, successful combat general. These are just some of his medals. Here's the funeral foot, and look at all those empty rows, which are surely probably expecting the high command to turn up, who obviously did not. And this is the simple cross for General Patton, buried in Luxembourg. General S. Patton, Jr., General Third Army, came from California. George Patton had made many high-ranking enemies in Moscow, Berlin, London, Washington, D.C. Patton's fiery determination to speak the truth had made many powerful men squirm, not only during the war, but afterwards. His public statements praising the German army for their matchless skills as fighting men, while criticizing the Soviet Union as the real enemy of freedom, led some to see Patton as a threat to the New World Order. Here's a Red Army poster. It gives a nice impression, but that's not the reality. When you look at, this is from our board member, Patrick Johnson, who's the top missiologist in the world today, top statistician. Christians killed in the 20th century. Notice, the biggest murderers of Christians has been the Soviet Union, victims of Stalin's purge, especially in the 1930s. And most people killed by governments in the 20th century, most of those have been communists. These are also Patrick Johnson's statistics. And again, you can see the rise and fall of communism, the greatest rise immediately after the First World War, immediately after the Second World War, the great rise a little bit during the Cold War, and what happened in 1988? We defeated the Soviets in Angola, and they lost in Afghanistan, they lost all over the place, and suddenly Berlin Wall fell, and freedom came to many countries. But this interim could have been avoided if General Patton had been taken seriously back in 1945, or if the West had not saved the Soviet Union in 1941 with Lend-Lease. Quite a story with, you can learn more from In the Face of Evil and Agenda. The point is, while they promised them freedom, they themselves are slaves of corruption. 2 Peter 2 verse 19 applies to a lot of governments. From the beginning, many did not believe that Patton's death was accidental. He had survived several remarkable accidents, including when his personal aircraft was almost shot down by British Spitfire in April 1945, when he was flying this plane, which plainly does not look like it's clear American markings, it's an unarmed plane. Why would a Spitfire try to shoot that down? Sergeant Robert Thompson's military records were burned on the 12th of July 1973 when a fire swept through the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, Missouri, destroying 18 million official military personnel files. Lieutenant Bubba's accident report also disappeared. A 1953 request for a copy of the report received the official response, noting report of investigation is not on file. Casualty branch has no papers on file regarding the accident. There's no information on the accident and Patton's aide, General Herbert Gay's personal file. The report organized by General Godfrey Keyes, Commander 7th Army, also went missing. In fact, the only report that remained in circulation was a document allegedly written 1952, 7 years later, signed by Private Woodring, Patton's driver. However, when asked about this in 1979, Woodring swore he had never made such a statement. He'd never signed his name to it. He believed the paperwork was fabricated. The vehicle on display at Patton's Museum at Fort Knox, Kentucky, has been proven to not be the vehicle in which General Patton was driving on that fateful day. In fact, the engine and chassis numbers have even been scratched out. Why? Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away justice from the righteous man. So who killed General Patton? There's a lot of mysteries, a lot of theories about this. Here's the vehicle after the accident. General Patton and his dog. This is such a sad picture. His dog by the general's trunk and equipment being shipped back to America. Patton will be buried in Luxembourg against the wishes of his wife. Why did they want to get him underground so fast? Why no autopsy? Why no major officials or leaders at his funeral? Very strange. But notice monument to General Patton with his dog, faithful dog next to it. In 1979, OSS agent Major Douglas Bazzotta asserted he had been part of a hit team that was tasked to assassinate General Patton. He had fired a low-velocity projectile at the back of the general's neck, basically an air rifle firing something like a bolt in order to snap the general's neck and cause paralysis. He had wedged the window down so that it could not be raised up, and he was hidden in a place where the accident would occur, so that as the accident occurred, he shot the general in the neck to break his neck, make it look like an accident, but because it wasn't a bullet, this was a bolt lying on a ground of the, or anywhere around it would assume to be just something, you know, broken glass and all that from a fender bender accident. Nobody would really notice it. When Patton failed to die and showed signs of recovery, he was then murdered in hospital by Soviet NKVD agents who had the right kind of injections that they couldn't, and remember there was no autopsy. Bazzotta swore that Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the OSS, paid him $10,000 plus another $800 in expenses for his role in Patton's death. Now, Douglas Bazzotta, who had left the Army as a major in 1947, was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, 4 Purple Hearts. You get a Purple Heart for being injured in battle. And Francis Croix de Guerre, with 2 palms, was later hired to work for the US government as Special Assistant to the Secretary of the Navy. And OSS agent Douglas Bazzotta later wrote of his meeting at Claridge's Hotel in London with Wild Bill Donovan. Douglas, I do indeed have a problem. It's extreme disobedience of General George Patton and of his very serious disregard for orders for the common cause. Shall I kill him, sir? Bazzotta asked. Yes, Douglas. You do exactly what you must. Now, Bazzotta didn't say this to a author. He said this at an official meeting of all the JEDPAs, all the surviving OSS people gathered in Washington, D.C., hundreds of them, CIA and OSS people, at a meeting amongst his peers, and most of them believed him. Nobody seemed to disbelieve. You know, it's one thing to just say this to one group, but he spoke it to the group who were his peers in the OSS, and they believed him. And he handed over all of his papers and so on to this author who produced the book, Target Patton, which I've read, by Robert Wilcox. He gave all of his files over there. And Robert, this is a real windfall for any journalist to get these kinds of papers. William Colby, a former OSS agent who went on to become head of the Central Intelligence Organization, praised Bazzotta in his 1978 book entitled Honorable Men. From this building in Virginia. Here's a CIA headquarters in Virginia, also known as the Cloud. So, interesting, an OSS operative who was praised and highly decorated by the CIA, he said, "I was assigned by the founder of the CIA, Donovan, to murder Patton." Now, some have come to recognize General Patton as the first casualty of the Cold War. Patton's insights and his convictions are considered a threat to the New World Order. Amos 5:15, hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gate. There are books and films that have come out on Patton, first victim of the Cold War, this one's called. Of course, the Patton film, George C. Scott's probably the most famous role, doesn't deal with his death, but deals with some of his life. Here's some quotes from Patton. "We herd sheep, we drive cattle, we lead people. Lead me, follow me, or get out of my way. If anyone is thinking alike, somebody isn't thinking." So he didn't like conformity. "Matrimony, when a man gets married, he must be just as careful to keep his wife's love as he was to get it. It would be very sad for both of them if he said to himself, now that I have you, I need not worry about losing you. Don't do that ever. Politicians are the lowest form of life on earth. Liberal Democrats are the lowest form of politicians. He should know. To me, it seems certain that the fatalistic teachings of Muhammad and utter degradation of woman is the outstanding cause for the arrested development of the Arab. He's exactly as he was around the year 700 while we have kept on developing." Talk about politically incorrect. "A good plan, violently executed now, is better than a perfect plan, executed next week." In military, that's true. By the way, this quote was on a billboard at 6th Infantry. We had lots of quotes from General Patton. "No person ever won a war by dying for his country, won it by making the other poor, dumb individual die for his." And I mean, that's one Patton quote. "The test of success is not when you do, when you're on top, success, or how high you bounce when you hit the bottom." It's true. We can all fall, but how high will we bounce back? "Moral courage is the most valuable and usually the most absent characteristic in men. Some men have physical courage, but very few have moral courage. No sane man is unafraid in battle, but discipline produces in him a form of vicarious courage." Yeah. Courage is an absence of fear. Courage is doing your duty in spite of your fear. "Accept the challenges so that you can feel the exhilaration of victory. We promised the Europeans freedom. It would be worse than dishonorable not to see that they have it. This might mean war with the Russians, but what of it? If we have to fight them, now is the time. From now on, we will get weak and they will get stronger." As one filmmaker said, Patton was a genius of war, and he stands out as someone who went beyond knowing how to win battles tactically, but philosophically held the attitude of a leader. But he was a straight talker who couldn't play the political game, and he paid a high price for it. They killed him because he had politically incorrect views. General Patton was a prophetic voice during crucial moments of American history, offering a warning that had been otherwise silent. In light of those who opposed Patton, enemies and allies alike, is it any wonder why 70 years later, many would still question his untimely death? Even today, his silence can be heard. This, by the way, was the prayer that his chaplain wrote that he handed out during the Battle of the Bulge. "Almighty and most merciful Father, we humbly beseech thee of thy great goodness to restrain these immoderate rains with which we have had to contend. Grant us fair weather for battle. Graciously hearken to us as soldiers who call upon thee, that armed with thy power, we may advance from victory to victory and crush the oppression and wickedness of our enemies and establish thy justice amongst men and nations." I don't think you get prayers like this very often these days. He wrote books like War as I Knew It, and there's war diaries from people, patent papers that his daughters got published, and those contain explosive things. The Unknown Patton, the Patton Museum, and some of his medals. And then they produced this Patton tank, the main battle tank, in 1947, which really was the Cold War warrior. And by the way, if you've seen the film The Battle of the Bulge, no Tiger tanks or Panther tanks in that. They used Patton tanks for the German army. Just one of those totally inaccurate things in a Hollywood film. This film, Patton, is pretty good, although it decides to avoid all the controversy of his death. It doesn't even go there at the end of the war. And it's a well-made film. Target Pattern is the book that inspired a lot of what I presented tonight, but I used other sources too. Killing Pattern by Bill O'Reilly is weak. It promises more than it delivers. He doesn't want to come down until he asks questions and doesn't bring out any answers. Silence Pattern is a film that was planned to bring out, and then it just disappeared with the filmmaker. And the other books that also look behind the scenes at this, that try to make sense of the chaos of what's happened in the Second World War, Saving the Soviet Union, and so on. The Secret War was one of the most incredible books I read, of the unsealed materials that had been sealed for 70 years. And when it came out, GCHQ, Enigma Code, and as generals have written the front of this book, said this requires all history books, Second World War, to be rewritten. And to be honest, so does Hess, Hitler, and Churchill, the real turning point of the Second World War. And so does Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, how Britain lost its empire and the West lost the world. I've read all these books, and I must say, these books change one's perspective on everything to do with the Second World War. So, any questions, any comments? I know this has been very long, but it's a massive story.
Has George S. Patton?
Yes.
What does the S stand for? You know,
I'm slightly stumped. I forget. I think it's Spencer. George S. Patton. We will have to check. I think you had a glass of water for me.
Yeah.
I understand. I just forgot to equip myself. Other questions, comments, observations, criticisms? Patton is certainly the most controversial, contentious character ever, but I've met some people who are real Patton hero fans, and you can understand why he inspired a lot of confidence in his men, but you can understand why politicians hate him. But he doesn't like them either. Yes, Brian.
I mean, the let's go Eastern Europe in what you're saying, and you can see practically that's what happened. They were behind the Iron Curtain for those many years. So can you just say a bit more about perhaps the motivations for that, to allow Russia to take those territories and come right to the Eastern Europe?
Yes. Freedom Betrayed, written by President Herbert Hoover, shows that, in fact, this was the plan from the very beginning. The globalists wanted to destroy Western Christian Europe. And of course, the first target was the Soviet Union, which the First World War's first primary goal was to destroy Tsarist Russia, betray them in the hands of the communists. So you can see the hands of the Illuminati, the Sabbateans, the Marxists behind what happened in 1914, leading up to the Bolshevik Revolution, 1917. But the Soviet Union was in a very bad way and was about to collapse in 1940. What they managed to do is revive the Soviet Union with this massive influx of technology transfer, colossal amounts of weaponry that poured into the Soviet Union. The goal was what we're seeing today, globalism. They're moving, the whole goal was globalism, breaking the old order, breaking Christian Europe, breaking the old stable nation states and bringing about a globalist one world government which could be easily controlled. So I believe that this was deliberate. This wasn't just tragic accident. This was plainly conspired for, planned, deliberate. And Professor Sutton, in his books Wall Street and the Bankrolling of the Bolshevik Revolution, and The Best Enemy Money Can Buy, and those sort of books, I think he's documented also without a shadow of a doubt that it's Western capitalists who funded the Bolshevik Revolution, saved the Soviet Union, and are now in the hands of the Communist Party of China and using China also for their goals. And even using the virus, the coronavirus, and the lockdowns and the vaccines in order to advance the globalist agenda. So I think we're facing the same enemies all the way along. The same enemies which are summarized in Revelation 13. One world government, one world economic system, one world interfaith religion under the beast. That's what's behind it. And that's what Ian Smith came to this conclusion to some extent towards the end of his life. A man who spent 6 years flying on the Royal Rhodesian Air Force, fighting for the Allies in the Second World War. He said, You know, if we had known then what we know now, we would not have been trying to save the Soviet Union. We thought we were fighting for Western Christian civilization and democracy and freedom. And in the end, we betrayed all these people in Eastern Europe to the Soviet Union. And we didn't realize that the very people that we'd been fighting for, Churchill and FDR, had already planned the betrayal of us in Africa into the hands of Marxist dictators. So Africa would have been better off staying out of the war, or if we lost the war, or even better, if we just joined and destroyed the Soviet Union. So that would have saved us all a lot of grief, to quote Ian Smith. And I've come across a few veterans who think like that. People actually fought in the Second World War come to the conclusion that, you know, honestly, we were on the wrong side. Should have sat this one out or fought Stalin. Honestly, how we got suckered into this. And the propaganda was good. I mean, you know, we're on the side of freedom and justice. But in the end, we weren't.
You can't explain away Nazi Germany was. It had to be stopped.
And it would have been.
Yeah.
But as Churchill, Hitler, and Unnecessary War by Pat Buchanan points out, there was no need to go to war to end what was going on in Germany. In fact, the real problem started after the bombing of Germany and after the 1,000 bomber raids. Then things really got bad. But the behavior in Germany, he puts it there, Pat Buchanan, who was a presidential candidate, he's also Ronald Reagan's historian and researcher, writer, during the Reagan years. And Pat Buchanan says, Hitler's victims' death toll by 1939 at the beginning of the war with Poland numbered up to about 160. No more than 200 had died under the Nazis up to then. Most of the people they'd killed were Nazis, actually, like Ernst Röhm and so on. Whereas Stalin's death toll at that stage was already 36 million. And we chose to make an alliance with Stalin and go to war with Germany and basically make them more radical. Because they only started to get radical during the war. Without the war, the Germans would have gotten rid of the National Socialists in time. You didn't need a world war and millions of people to die to get rid of an unacceptable form of government. There's many ways of doing it. The World War's goal was not to stop socialism, it advanced socialism. National Socialism is evil. International Socialism is even more evil. Because bad as National Socialism is, at least it's one country. International Socialism wants the entire globe. And the Allies lined up with International Socialism. Now, this is from Pat Buchanan in Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. But President Herbert Hoover, in Freedom Betrayed, shows that the United States government actually connived to put Poland up to not handing the Danzig Corridor back to Germany, which is 98% German anyway, and alienated Germany, who wanted Poland as an ally in the war against Russia. And that America put Poland up to resisting this very reasonable handing back the Danzig Corridor. And then also cajoled Britain and France, bribed them with all kinds of promises behind the scenes to give this war guarantee to Poland. So instead of America being dragged into the war reluctantly, what Herbert Hoover, remember President Herbert Hoover, points out is that the Franklin Delano Roosevelt government was behind the war. They initiated the war. They put up Poland to it and then betrayed them and the whole of Eastern Europe. They put up Britain and France to it and then stood back and let them wear themselves out. And then before America came in to help Britain, they got Britain to bankrupt themselves, send all the gold to them, send all South Africa's gold to them, give them bases all over the place, like in Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, all over the place. They basically shook Britain down and ensured the bankruptcy of the British Empire and ensured access after the war to all the raw materials and the markets of Africa and everywhere else where the British Empire was, guaranteeing the destruction of the British Empire. And Churchill understood he's basically giving up the British Empire to get American aid. And the Americans just put up the war in the first place. This was such a globalist scam on every level. And remember, beware the victor's version. It's in the nature of victors to exaggerate the crimes of their enemies and to cover up their own atrocities. And certainly to cover up their real motives of what they've been doing. But the world didn't get better after 1939. It's gotten worse. Much worse. I mean, as my own dad said, if we could have seen how Britain became afterwards, we would have fought against the real enemy, our own government. What they've done to destroy Britain. Then they were talking about wanting to protect Britain from Operation Sea Lion, which turns out to be complete fabrication. There never was a plan to invade Britain. And we know it. Pat Buchanan says, Germany never had an aircraft carrier. They never designed a plane that could land on the aircraft carrier. They never had a landing craft. How could they go for world domination when they didn't have 10% the naval capacity that Britain had and not a single aircraft carrier? How could they invade London in Britain when they didn't have a landing craft? It's ludicrous. But Operation Sea Lion was lifted up that the British thought they were at risk. Germany had no desire to invade Britain. They had no desire to ever invade Britain. There never was a plan. Operation Sea Lion was some propaganda stunt. There was no serious concept ever to invade. This idea that, oh, if we hadn't fought, we'd all be speaking German. Rubbish. Germany was nationalist. They weren't globalist. The British were globalists, the Americans were globalists, the Soviets were globalists, even the French were globalists for world domination. Germany had no globalist ambitions. That's why they didn't have an aircraft carrier. Their ambitions were on their own borders, immediate borders. And destroying the Soviet Union as a communist base was one of them, which would have served their interests. As Pat Buchanan says, and Herbert Hoover, if we just sat it out and watched Germany destroy the Soviet Union, what harm would that do? Why get involved? Why throw Western civilization in the path of the tanks that are moving eastwards anyway? There was no ambitions in the West. And that's why this book, Hess, Real Turning Point of the Second World War, he offers in 1941, we'll withdraw from everywhere in the West, Norway, Denmark, France, Netherlands, withdraw full back to pre-1939 borders. Just give us a free hand in the East. No need for D-Day. No need for anyone to die after 1941. It's the same thing with Russia right now. What was Russia asking for? Recognize Donbass and Luhansk and Crimea, and that's it.
And Crimea, at least.
Yeah,
that to be a neutral.
Crimea.
That's a very reasonable request.
Isn't that better than the possibility of getting to World War? How many people have died so far in Ukraine the last 8 months? Going on 9 months now? It's insane. Is this necessary? Is it worth it? What's the purpose?
The EU,
that lady, yeah. But can you see? Can you see the lie? I'm sure it's more. But the lies. And they carry on and on with this. But you can see who's benefiting? Not the Ukrainians. Not the Russians. Who's benefiting? I mean, the globalists are benefiting. They're using the Ukrainians cynically as pawns for their globalist agenda. I fear just like the globalists used Poland, and even to an extent Britain and France, for their ends. And they didn't care about what their own troops suffered either. I see what's going on right now, the demonization of Putin. You know, he's going to take over the whole world and all this sort of thing to justify. Well, who's taking over the whole world? It's more like the globalist petrodollar crowd. What we're facing now is globalist versus nationalist. I see a lot of similarities. In fact, the way they start to demonize Putin, I looked and thought, it's the same way they were dealing with Ian Smith and Peter W. Butzer back in the days I was growing up, and the same way they've dealt with every enemy is Hitler. Every enemy is demonized, and we Churchill, you know. And this is what Pat Buchanan points out. We've got a Churchillian cult where they demonize every enemy to justify their war lobby, war hawks, as they call them. And it's for globalist agenda. They're doing it basically for economics. The propaganda out there is Ukraine a democracy? Is there freedom and democracy there? Here's this Zelensky, as corrupt as hell, bans his opposition, locks up the journalist. No freedom of the press, no freedom of speech, no freedom for other political parties, and we're fighting for democracy there? So I think they're lying just now, and they were lying just then, and I wasn't alive during the Second World War, but I know enough people who feel they were lied to then too. And you know I'm not a pacifist. I believe there's time to fight, but I think we fight to defend our own countries. I don't believe in these foreign adventures. I don't think the Americans have made the world a better place with any of their wars overseas. I think the Swiss have made the world a better place by what they've done through the Red Cross and diplomacy and being neutral. They've helped a lot of people in suffering areas. But I don't think sending your armies overseas to fight foreign wars makes anyone's life better. The Americans have an unbroken record since 1917 of making the world a worse place. Everywhere they go militarily, like Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, wherever they go to make it worse. I think if they just stayed home, everyone would have been much better off. Anyway, that's my perspective. And obviously, Patton was a war-loving creature. He loved to fight, but he felt angry when he thought we've been used. We've been allied with the wrong people. The Soviets are the real enemy. It's an interesting perspective. But as you can see, like last week when I gave on John and Charles Wesley, we don't have to agree with these people on things to learn a lot from them. I mean, not everyone I present I agree with everything on. And there's a lot of things that Patton says that is quite shocking and that we can't agree with. But the fact still is he's a colourful character, he had very strong views, and obviously he died for them. But the people who used them, I mean, imagine that. He fights for their cause for all those years, and they feel no loyalty to him. Just like the Soviets, who's the greatest hero of the Bolshevik Revolution? Leon Trotsky. He ends up with an axe in the head from the NKVD. Killed in Mexico by Stalin. And he's the hero of the revolution. Just like in Animal Farm, Snowball, the hero of the revolution. He gets chased up and killed by the Dobermans of Napoleon, who's the pig who didn't do anything for the revolution, but he takes power after Snowball's won the farm. And then Napoleon trains the Dobermans to chase Snowball out and kill him. It's all based on what Stalin did to Trotsky and his ilk. So if our communist guys could realize, just think of this, who's the hero of the ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe? Josiah Chongororo. Josiah Chongororo is the leader of the ZANU-PF military, terrorist, guerrillas, whatever they want to call him. And he gets murdered by Mugabe just before the election so that Mugabe can become the prime minister. And who's the hero of the revolution in Mozambique? Eduardo Mondlane, who gets murdered by Michel just in time as the Portuguese betray the country so Michel can become the first leader. Communists murder their own. Who's the hero of the ANC and the Southern Communist Party? Chris Hani, who gets murdered just before the 1994 elections. And while we know who got the blame, Bantu Holomisa, General Bantu Holomisa, to this day maintains that it was an inside job. Thabo Mbeki and so on were behind the murder of Chris Hani. And while Janusz might have pulled the trigger, he was set up and the ANC pulled back the support, his security. And Winnie Mandela maintained that to a dying day that Chris Hani was murdered by the ANC. Because he would have plainly been Mandela's successor. And Mbeki and Zuma and Ramaphosa wouldn't have had a chance. Because Chris Hani was very eloquent. I've debated Chris Hani. I mean, I know I've met him. And argued with him in front of the press club in Washington, D.C. Chris Hani is the sharpest crayon in the box. And he could speak well. He's a much better speaker. And even more charismatic than Nelson Mandela. Chris Hani gets murdered by the ANC before it. So the Marxists have an unbroken record of murdering their own. In fact, even Mao Zedong, he murdered the first president of Red China as well in the Cultural Revolution. So I've got a whole track record here showing that it's typical of Marxists to murder their own, the revolutionaries. Now, if this could be understood by the EFF, the vanguard of the revolution end up with a bullet in the back of the neck because they can't be trusted. Once they've overthrown one government, the politicians who use them and are now going to betray them can't leave them alive because they know how to overthrow a country, they might overthrow them too. So they're the first to get in the neck, literally. They'll use a Patton, then they'll kill him. They'll use a Hani, and so on. I mean, this is just revolution 101. Sorry, I'm giving a separate lecture here. Any other comments or questions? This is a big one. It's huge. It's massive. It's Patton is a fascinating character, one of the most colourful characters in American history.